أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Verse number 123. يا أيها الذين آمنوا قاتلوا الذين يلونكم من الكفار وليجدوا فيكم غلظة وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. O you who have faith, point the faithless who are in your vicinity, and let them find security in you, and know that Allah is with the God-wary. Now this verse does not seem to have much connection with previous verses which talks about munafiqun and also Ghazwatu Tabuk. Apparently, since these are very last verses which are revealed to the Prophet, this verse is an injunction to Mu'minun to have wars on the infidels and the faithless for the spread of Islam. The injunction is that every Muslim should fight the infidels in their vicinity, so that they gradually, from every direction, they start to expand Islam, the message of Islam, and to consequently expand the Islamic territory. There are a few points here that we have to mention. As you know, jihad is one of the pillars of Islamic faith. Jihad, not in the sense of just spiritual strive, spiritual efforts to somehow develop one's own soul, but as qital, as it is mentioned in the Quran. Qital means fighting, war. Qital is one of the most conspicuous types of jihad, and it is something which has been, of course, recommended by Islam as a means of spreading the faith and defending the faith. Now, jihad is divided into two types. One is the defensive jihad, and the other is the offensive jihad. Defensive jihad means when someone attacks Muslim territory or attacks a Muslim area, everyone is obliged, everyone has to defend the area, the location of Muslims, by whatever means. This is called defensive jihad. Offensive jihad is when, without any initiation by any outside force, by any infidel force or any intruder, Muslims start a fight to convey the message of Islam to the people. This is called offensive jihad. Now, the opinion of the jurists are mixed about the offensive jihad, however, they are unanimous on defensive jihad. They are unanimous on defensive jihad in the sense that when an attack is done against a Muslim land, Muslim property, Muslim life, then it is duty of everyone to take arms and defend. And in this injunction, there is no difference between man and woman, there is no difference between those who are capable or and those who are old, sick, and incapacitated in any way. They have to, all of them, defend by any means that they can. And also in this jihad, there is no need for an order or an injunction by the leader of the Muslims. Because maybe leader of the Muslims is killed in the at the beginning of that war. It is compulsory on every Muslim to defend Muslim identity, Muslim land, property, life, and whatever is there. So this is something on which Waqf-e-Fuqaha has no hesitation. And it is something, of course, inside human nature, even if religion doesn't tell us something about it. It is something innate in human nature to defend and to not let intruders to come and invade one's own possessions and property or belongings or whatsoever. So this is something about which there is no disagreement. However, about the offensive jihad, whether Muslims are allowed to initiate a war to convey the message of Islam to people of other areas. Well, I stress on conveying the message of Islam to people of other areas because, first of all, it is not allowed for Muslims to invade other territories just to expand their own territory or to gain booties of war or to gain wealth or whatever. It is not allowed, certainly. The only way of jihad, offensive jihad, is when you want to convey the message of Islam. And this is why in this verse it is said, قَاتِلُ الَّذِينَ يَلُونَكُمْ مِنَ الْكُفَّارِ. This description, the very term kuffar, the faithless, fight them. It is somehow alluding to the fact that this is not for expanding the territory, this is not for bringing wealth to your own location or whatsoever. It is something to somehow spread the message, remove the kuffar who are not allowing this message to reach other people and then convey the message to them. So this is one thing. The other thing is that although this type of jihad is certainly established in Islam, as this verse is mentioning, this verse is about offensive jihad certainly. It doesn't say defend yourself against the kuffar who are trying to attack you. It says قَاتِلُ الَّذِينَ يَلُونَكُمْ مِنَ الْكُفَّارِ. Any kuffar who are in your vicinity, fight with them. And it means that gradually you have to expand this message from one area to another area. Whoever is closer to you, start fighting with them and spread the message. Now, another difference of opinion here is that, is this something only for the time of the Prophet, or it is something which is to be continued by Muslims after the Prophet to the end of the time until there is an infidel on the earth, there is a faithful on the earth. Now, the verse itself is very general. It is an injunction on Muslims to spread the message and to fight the kuffar. And this is why, of course, that after the Prophet, the Muslims started to invade other lands, other territories, and they expanded to Egypt, to Roman lands, to Iran. And it was something in the mind of the Muslims that, yes, this is something that we have to do. We have to go on jihad, and we have lots of ahadith about the merits of mujahideen. And if we go to the wars of the people at the just formative period of Islam, just after the Prophet, we will see that they were boasting in taking part in those jihads that they had against Iran, against Egypt, against Rome, and they somehow succeeded to expand Islam into other territories. Now, the point is, although immediately after the Prophet, still the situation was as such that Muslims were fighting really for the sake of Islam and to convey the message. However, by passing of the time, the whole center of Islamic rule became a type of, turned to be a kind of kingdom. And then it was the king fighting for territories, for booties, for wealth, rather than fighting to spread the message of Islam. And in fact, many of the rulers after the prophets, especially at the time of Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas, they were not really caring about the message of Islam. They were putting many ulama, scholars of Islam, under very hard conditions, imprisoning them, torturing them. So they were not very much in favor of spreading the message. They were in favor of spreading the territory, making a very huge empire of their own rule and governance. So the verse really doesn't match with their attitude towards expansion of Islam or expansion of their territory as they saw it. So Muslims started to think, is this verse really going to continue like that? And Muslims are allowed to fight with the kuffar who are in their vicinity or not? Now, according to Sunni jurisprudence, this verse is something that has to be continued. And if there is a Muslim center of governance, a Muslim center in which Muslim rule is established, or a khilafah, so to speak, then they are allowed to initiate fights against the kuffar, if they have, of course, the power, if they have the might to do that. Otherwise, they have to, of course, make treaties and truce, peace treaty and something like that. According to the Shi'i opinion, of course, the mainstream majority Shi'i opinion, this injunction cannot be continued after the Prophet and the Imams. It is something, because usually the intention of people, especially the intention of the rulers, are not to convey the message. Their intention is to expand the territory and to somehow make their empire, their territory bigger and larger. This is only for the time when the ruler is immaculate. And they can, or we can say, 100% surely, that yes, this is only for the intention of expansion of the message of Islam, rather than expanding the territory. So, majority of Shi'i ulama, scholars, almost all of them, when I say majority, the minority is very, very scarce, very little. They say that this verse should be implemented after the Prophet only when the Imam allows it, or only when the Imam has the power to rule. Otherwise, this is not allowed, and Muslims, especially at the time of Ghiba, they are not allowed to expand their territory. As I said, the reason is that this expansion is not just for the sake of what Ayah wants us to do, to convey the message of Islam. So there would be a type of stop is put at all this type of jihad activities of the Muslim at a type of Ghaibah. As I said, this is quite different from defensive jihad, which is to defend Muslim territory and land if it is invaded by the faithless, by the infidels, or by any non-Muslim group. However, in the sense of expansion, it is not allowed according to the Shi'i. Now, according to the Sunni faith, when there is not one central khilafah, as we usually didn't have it after the Abbasid period, except for the time of Ottomans, and nowadays it is very difficult, it would be very difficult to establish a central khilafah for all Muslim lands, then there would be difficulty of when these different Muslim countries encounter each other, what should they do? And what would be the relationship? If they want to wage a jihad, whether they wage this jihad with supporting each other, or they do it alone, if there is a fight or war between, if there is an initiative from a Muslim country to start a fight with an infidel group of people, whether it is compulsory on other countries to help them or not. Of course, if they are attacked, it is obligation of everyone to help. This is what, there is no doubt about it. If one piece of Muslim territory is attacked, it is obligation of everyone else to help. However, if a Muslim ruler decides to initiate a war against another country, an infidel or a faithless people, then whether it would be the obligation of others to help or not, these are the issues which of course should be discussed in Sunni jurisprudence. And of course, since it has been out of practice for long, these issues have not been discussed very much, so we leave it there as well, because there is no much practical benefit in discussing them at the moment. The only thing, just to conclude, is to know that this particular verse is about the offensive jihad at the time of the Prophet. And if we say it could have been continued further to the time of the first four caliphs, and of course it continued, Muslims continue to think that this is enforced even at the time of Banu Umayyah, when again the land, Muslim territory was expanding. According to the Shia faith, of course, this is only allowed when the Imam is present and would allow it or would agree with it. Otherwise, it would be unlawful to initiate such a war. So the verse said, O you who have faith, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, قاتلوا الذين يلونكم من الكفار, fight the faithless who are in your vicinity. Now, nowadays some extremist Muslims, they take this in an individual sense. For example, they say, if you are living somewhere and there are kuffar around you, you are allowed to kill them or to start fighting against them. Something very funny ideas which have come out of a type of personal understanding of the verses of the Quran. Certainly these are not between individuals. These are not between different groups in a society. It is something which is between states, between different countries, rather than between individuals. So fight the faithless who are in your vicinity, وَلْيَجِدُوا فِيكُمْ غِلْظَةً, and let them find severity in you. This غِلْظَةً here doesn't mean irresponsible violence, of course. It doesn't mean rashness. It means a strength and severity, seriousness in what you are doing in your relationship with them. وَلْيَجِدُوا فِيكُمْ غِلْظَةً وَعَلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُتَّقِينَ, and know that Allah is with the God-weary. Certainly, if you are going to start and initiate these battles for the sake of the world, then Allah would leave you to yourself. You fight them, you might have stronger power, you overcome them, they might have a stronger power, they overcome you. Allah is not going to interfere here if you are not muttaqin. If you are muttaqin, of course Allah is going to support you and you are going to succeed in this type of initiation of battle to spread the message of Islam. So a very direct warning coming again when every injunction of the Quran is mentioned, that here as well, you bear in mind that if you are muttaqi, if you have taqwa, then Allah is going to support you. If you don't have taqwa, you are left to yourself and to your own powers and to your own measures. وَعَلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُتَّقِينَ, Now, then again, we go back to the story of Munafiqun. As I said, this is a single verse inserted here about the initiation of war by Muslims. And since these are the very last verses revealed to the Prophet, the injunction is inserted here as a type of measure for the expansion of the message of Islam. Verse 124, وَإِذَا مَا أُنزَلَتْ سُورَةٌ فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَيُّكُمْ زَادَتْهُ هَذِهِ إِيمَانًا فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا فَزَادَتْهُمْ إِيمَانًا وَهُمْ يَسْتَبْشِرُونَ. Whenever a surah is sent down, there are some of them who say, which of you did it increase in faith? As for those who have faith, it increases them in faith, and they rejoice. وَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجْسًا إِلَى رِجْسِهِمْ وَمَاتُوا وَهُمْ كَافِرُونَ. But as for those in whose heart is a sickness, it only adds defilement to their defilement, and they die while they are faithless. The verses are telling us very interesting things, and that is, right towards the end of the life of the Prophet, there were people around him who still had lots of doubt in their hearts about the Prophet. We usually think that if we were living at the time of the Prophet, if we were seeing the Prophet, interacting with him, listening to him, then of course we would have been saints and all doubts would have been removed from our hearts. Well, this is not the case, as is the case of many people who lived in Medina with the Prophet. It is all to do with one's own heart and one's own decision in the heart and in the deepest part of the soul. Otherwise, to live with the Prophet would not help, as to recite the Quran would not help. Seeing other signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would not help. And there were towards the end of the life of the Prophet, many people in Medina who were in doubt, who were all the time increasing in their doubts. They were somehow going deeper and deeper in their disbelief by seeing the signs of the Prophet, peace be on him. The signs that would have helped others to increase their faith would have somehow made them to go deeper into disbelief, and this is because of the internal attitude. It is actually what we understand from these verses, is that it doesn't matter where you live, who you are living with, whether you are living with very saintly people or you are living with infidels, the important thing is what goes inside your heart. And if your heart is not ill, then everything you see is a sign of Allah and would increase your faith. If the heart is ill, whatever you see is going to increase doubt and disbelief in your heart. So the most important thing is the health of the heart, as of course we have in many other Surahs of the Quran. يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهَ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ. The day when you go to Allah, what would benefit you is a healthy heart. Otherwise, if the heart is not healthy, you are in danger. Now, whenever a surah is sent down, there are some of them who say, which of you did it increase in faith? أَيُّكُمْ زَادَتْهُ هَذِهِ إِيمَانًا. Because, of course, the verses of the Qur'an were to increase the faith, were to add to the knowledge of the people. And Prophet, peace be on him, was saying these things all the time, that verses of the Qur'an would increase the faith of the believers, verses of the Qur'an would strengthen believers in their commitment. However, these people who had illness in their heart, they saw that this is not the case. They are not increasing in faith. Rather, they are going deeper in disbelief, and they started to doubt about the words of the Prophet himself. So when a verse was revealed, when a surah was revealed, some of them would say, which of you did it increase in faith? So, meaning that apparently the Prophet is not telling the truth to us. He is not truthful. And then Allah mentions the standard statement that is seen everywhere in the Quran. فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا فَزَادَتْهُمْ إِيمَانًا وَهُمْ يَسْتَبْشِرُونَ. As for those who have faith, it increases them in faith. And they rejoice. They rejoice because, of course, their faith has increased. They rejoice because there is an enlightenment in their heart, enlightening for them new perspectives about the unseen, about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. However, as for those, وَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ, as for those in whose heart is a sickness, which are on the verge of nifaq, of course. There are three groups mentioned in the Quran, مؤمنون, منافقون, and those in whose heart there is a sickness. And those in whose heart there is a sickness, they are the ones who go hypocrite, and who go towards disbelieving. So those in whose heart is a sickness, فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجْسًا إِلَىٰ رِجْسِهِمْ, it only adds defilement to their defilement. Of course, defilement of the heart, which is doubt, which is shak and rave, as it is mentioned. And you have a hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam explaining this verse. He said, فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجِسًا إِلَىٰ رِجِسِهِمْ means فَزَادَتْهُمْ شَكًّا إِلَىٰ شَكِّهِمْ, a doubt over their doubt. The verses of the Qur'an, well, they act in two ways, two different ways, as we have it in many other verses as well. It would cure and it would add illness, depending on the heart that it lands. If the heart is cultivated, if the heart is healthy, then it increases the faith. If the heart is ill, then it increases the doubt. So, وَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجْسًا إِلَىٰ رِجْسِهِمْ, it only adds defilement to their defilement, and they die while they are faithless. And they die while they are faithless because, of course, the faith would completely move out of their hearts. Now, there is one very important concept in verse 124, and that is, if the heart is healthy, the ayat of the Qur'an, the verses of the Qur'an, would enlighten the heart. There is an effect on the heart when we recite the Qur'an, if the heart is healthy. And this is why, when the heart is healthy, when you have a good heart, as a favor from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then try to recite Quran as much as you can. Because this is going to increase your faith. This is going to increase enlightenment in your heart. And this is, of course, the objective of every mu'min, to get more faith, to get more enlightenment. And this is the effect of verses of the Quran. And all these ahadith that we have about the thawab of recitation of the Qur'an, especially in salah, if you recite the Qur'an while you are in salah, for example, you recite long surahs while you are in salah, because then the effect is more, because you are completely concentrating your attention towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then you recite the verses of the Qur'an, this is going to increase enlightenment and faith in your heart. And usually many mu'minun in the past, they received lots of enlightenment when they were reciting the Qur'an during their salat. We have many ahadith about it, many stories about it, even about A'imma alayhimu salam. We have this hadith that one of A'imma alayhimu salam, he recited إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ, and he repeated and repeated until he fainted. And when he was asked, I don't remember now which imam he was, when he was asked about it, he said, I repeated it until I heard it from the one who had revealed it. So the enlightenment, you can see the type of enlightenment. And even the Prophet, peace be on him, was told to repeat the Qur'an, to recite the Qur'an. The one to whom the Qur'an was revealed, he was told that he should recite the Qur'an in his salat. In Surah Muzammil, Ya أَيُّهَا Muzammil قُمِ اللَّيْلَ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. And then it says, وَرَتَّلَ الْقُرْآنَ تَرْتِيلًا. And recite Qur'an with concentration, slowly, so that you can absorb the enlightenment of the Qur'an. So if this is the case with the Prophet himself and with A'imma alayhimus salam, so is the case with other mu'minun as well. If there is a healthy heart and we recite the Qur'an, فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا فَزَادَتْهُمْ إِيمَانًا وَهُمْ يَسْتَبْشِرُونَ. Their faith would increase and they would become happy, they would rejoice. يَسْتَبْشِرُونَ meaning that they find a new enlightenment in their heart and this would give them joy and they rejoice of the enlightenment that they have received. وَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجْسًا إِلَى رِجْسِهِمْ. Of course, some people just recite the Qur'an over and over and they increase in doubt. They say, what are these things? What is God talking about, for example? وَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ فَزَادَتْهُمْ رِجْسًا إِلَى رِجْسِهِمْ. And this is, of course, not only about the Qur'an. Any sign of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have the same effect. If the heart is healthy, then the signs of Allah would increase faith. If the heart is ill, and illness comes when a person commits sin. And this is why some exegetes say, رِجْسًا إِلَى رِجْسِهِمْ means a sin over their sins. And it is actually the same thing. When we sin, the heart starts to become ill. And if the sins increase, the illness of the heart increases. And then the signs of Allah, the verses of the Qur'an, ayat of Allah, whether ayat in the Qur'an or ayat in the world, they start to have an adverse effect on a person's soul and on a person's heart. And they immediately, by seeing a difficulty, people start to doubt about the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is when heart is ill. There was a very interesting statement a couple of weeks ago. I saw it on the TV. A mine was exploded in the United States, and a few people were killed. And there was an interview. At the beginning, they said that everyone is saved except one person who has died, and then they said everyone has died except one person who was rescued. And they were interviewing someone on the TV, and he said that at the beginning of night we had a miracle and we rejoiced. Now in the morning we have started to even doubt about the existence of God because of what has happened. You see, a difficulty like that would start to work on the hearts of people who are sinful in a way that just by anything which happens, they start to doubt about the very existence of God and the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the status of an ill, of a heart which is sick. However, for the hearts which are healthy, everything that happens would increase in their faith and would somehow enlighten the way further for them, make things to become more clear for them. Everything would become a sign from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if this rajis is increased, فَزَادَتْهُمْ رَجِسًا إِلَىٰ رَجِسِهِمْ, then of course eventually what happens? وَمَاتُوا وَهُمْ كَافِرُونَ. They die while they are faithless. We leave the next verse, inshallah, next week. وَصَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَعَلَىٰ
Okay, brothers, sisters, we have a few minutes for question and answers. Yes, sir. Hello.
Hello.
Just a question. You said in Shia jurisprudence, it's very unlikely that you can have an offense to you unless there's the presence of the Imam. Now, in the time of Khalifa that we are in now, we basically rely on the authority of the Mujtahid based on the authority of the Imam. So, that would a Mujtahid have that authority? Could he, based on the fact that he is the representative of the 12th Imam,
No, this is what the ulama say. At the time of Mujtahid, when of course Mujtahid is ruling because of the ghaiba of the Imam, they are not allowed to start an offensive jihad. This is something that should be done by the Imam himself.
Sisters,
Mujtahid
is not
allowed to start.
You mentioned about the offensive jihad to spread the message of Islam. How can we see this in the light of this idea that you cannot force anybody to believe Taqiyya, and then you force it by taking over the land and spread the message like that? So how can we?
Well, the faith could never be forced into a heart, that's true. However, usually what was in the mind and what is something which is a fact actually, is that you cannot convey the message due to lots of obstacles, especially when there is a sovereign government that would not allow you to convey the message and go and preach Islam. Then you have to remove that government first, and then make the message to flow into other lands. And this is what actually happened at the beginning of Islam. People were not forced to Islam. It was only the case that the governments were removed, the lands were taken, and then people started to convert themselves. I think I mentioned this before, even in the case of Iran, the rate of conversion after the land was taken was so huge that it was disrupting the whole administration in Medina, so much so that that the second Caliph Umar ordered that no conversion should be accepted from Iranians anymore, because it would somehow disrupt the type of tax and jizya and the administration of land and everything. And he said that no conversion would be accepted from Iranians from Zoroastrianism to Islam anymore. Just leave them as Ahlul Kitab, accept them as Ahlul Kitab. However, it did not help. I mean, the conversion happened very quickly, the conversion to Islam. The only thing was that the message was reached, and then the conversion took place. It is not possible if a group of people, if a society is not willing to convert, it's not possible to force them, certainly. We have another example when Mongols attacked Iran, for example. They also wanted to somehow convert Iranians to their own religion. However, after a while, they converted themselves to Islam. And you will see that it is not something that you can do by terror, by force, by war. It is something that should happen in the heart itself. And the offensive jihad is only to remove the obstacles for conveying the message.
Speaking in previous ayats, when Allah exhorts Muslims to fight, you have shown us that you've been qualified to that particular time because Muslims were not fighting and they were being attacked. What makes this ayah different in that it's not limited by qualifications like that?
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Well, in previous ayahs, yeah. In this surah, when Allah tells Muslims to fight, further up there have been other verses where they've shown that the kuffar are attacking you, why don't you fight them?
Mm-hmm.
Allah can say that because Muslims were not fighting when they should have been fighting in their defense.
Mm-hmm.
So those ayahs which have been exhorting people to fight have been qualified.
Yeah.
In this case, why is this an exception and you're saying it's un-
unlimited in that it's not bound by those qualifications.
By the qualification of depends, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because there is no such qualification in the verse, it just says that fight whoever of infidel is in your vicinity. And it doesn't, of course, qualify with defending yourself. It means that you can initiate a war against them. This is what the ayah says. You might say, okay, in the light of other ayat, previous ayat, we might qualify this. But this is something that Muslims have not understood from this verse. At least the exegetes and jurists have not understood this from the verse.
Even in the previous ayat, the qualification hasn't been in the same verse. It's been three or four verses further down.
Mm-hmm.
Allah talks about fighting, then he talks about something else. Then he says, can't you see these guys are breaking their treaties, they're attacking you, they're taking this and that. So the qualification hasn't been in the same verse. It's been further down or further up.
Yeah.
In this case, can't you, I'm just wondering what makes this different in that we don't take qualifications from further up or further down.
I think that the very undertone of the verse is such that it would not allow such qualification. And this is what Muslims have understood from it.
Shaykh, when we talk about Muslim land being attacked, and we discuss that, then it becomes our duty to defend it any way we can. Does the ruler not have to be a Muslim ruler or a just ruler who then declares that yes, the Muslim land has been attacked, now it is your duty, or how does it work?
Well, what the fatwa says is that no, you shouldn't even wait for any command to come. Of course, when there is a sovereign state, and they decide about the tactics of defense. They might just tell you withdraw, come back, and evacuate the cities and come to the center. These are, of course, the tactics of the defense that might be taken. But if there is no such a central power to dictate these tactics, then it is compulsory upon every Muslim to group, Muslim coming to group and start a defense against the invaders. The idea which is in this fatwa is that at the very extreme cases where even there is no central government to dictate to you what to do, what tactics to take, it is compulsory, if you can, to defend the land against the invaders.
Let's take, for example, like Indian Pakistan involves U.S. attacked all Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Pakistan, they're all regarded Muslim lands. So when Pakistan was attacked by India, then it becomes a duty on all the Muslims to understand.
It would become a duty on all the Muslims, but of course, now that there are sovereign governments, then it is a decision that the governments should take how this tactic should be, the support should go there and how the tactics of the war should be. Of course, it would be very difficult nowadays to imagine that an individual would go and start defending. It would somehow make more difficulties than helping. However, as I said, there are extreme situations in which, for example, somewhere is attacked, especially, when we are talking about these extreme cases, these could be imagined, especially in old times, when, for example, there was not such a huge communication, a city was attacked, other cities did not know about it, for example, and people had to stand and defend rather than submitting to the kuffar, for example. However, nowadays, of course, the tactics, the methods are different, so we have to think what would be the best way to go about it.
As you said, this particular ayah is not very well understood, as there are different interpretations of the Shia and Sunni. Now, how do we defend this when it's very commonly quoted by the non-Muslims that Islam is very violent religion. And they especially quote that, and I have read it myself in the Daily Mail. And how to
which one? This study verse.
The Muslims are asked to fight the non-Muslims and kill wherever they are. How do we defend when we are told that your Quran says this and it is violent and Muslims are killing the non-Muslims and spreading these verses? How do we defend, how do we explain this act to the non-Muslims?
Well, depends if you are a Shia or if you are a Sunni. If you are a Shia, you say this is only for the time of the Immaculate Imam, and this is not something that Muslims would practice now. If you are a Sunni, again, what you can say is that this is when there is no treaty between Muslim country or Muslim sovereign power and the Kuffar. Now that we have treaties, international treaties, then of course we know how Islam would respect pact and treaty and something which has been agreed between two different parties. And of course now there are international laws which all Muslim countries are have accepted them, and this means there is a treaty and there is a pact. And when there is a treaty, the treaty is never violated by Muslims. And this is something that could be shown from different verses of the Quran. And certainly, if these treaties are broken, then of course every country has the right to somehow defend itself or to make new stipulations for the new treaty. So the answer is that now that we are in an international type of settlement, then of course Muslims are not allowed to break that so long as others will stick to it.
Okay, sisters?
Sheikh, you were mentioning that it's very difficult to force people to convert their religion. But in addition to the examples, for example, in the Philippines, which was a Muslim country, and it wasn't a Muslim country by armies, but by people visiting missionaries and trade and things like that, it was almost 90-100% Muslim. And then the Portuguese invaded, and they forcibly converted people to Christianity, and today it's a predominantly Christian country. So it does happen like that. So it may be wrong, but it does happen.
I don't know how this would happen. It might happen by terror. I mean, saying that either we kill everyone or you convert to Christianity. But even these terrorizing measures wouldn't last much. Usually there should be an inclination in the people themselves so that they accept it willingly. Otherwise, it would continue as a hidden thing. Until, of course, sometimes it reveals itself again. I mean, you can take the example of Muslim Russian republics. I mean, they were forced to leave their religion for a long time, and as soon as the force was taken, you see that they started to go back to their religion. They started to practice again. Of course, every case should be studied individually, but I think it would be very difficult, as the Quran says, La ikraha fi din. It is not possible really to force a heart into faith.
Taking the point from Brother Samfara, what he raised, the point that he raised. In this similar situation around the in Spain, where 100% of the people were Muslim, and they are all Christians now, so they have not reverted back to Islam.
As I said, unless there is a tendency in people themselves, I mean, those who were very strong in their faith, they were killed. And we know that the type of Islam that was spread in Spain right from the beginning by Umayyads was not that type of Islam which was spread by the Prophet. That's why the shaky position would made easy conversion to Christianity again. Of course there are some force at the beginning, but if the faith is not deep rooted, this happens. You can see, for example, you can mention other examples which have gone into completely opposite side. For example, the Fatimids in Egypt, they tried to convert Muslims from Sunni faith to Shi'i faith, and they used lots of force, but they couldn't. And as soon as the Fatimid rule was removed, then all people, of course, everyone who had said that we are Shias now, they returned to the Sunni Islam again, because they could not convince people about Shiism, certainly. This might have been the case in Spain or in other areas, that just for a while Islam showed an appearance, and then as soon as the force was taken, was removed, then the people converted back.
You mentioned about the offensive war, and one of the reasons you cited was that there are impediments in propagating the message to the foreign lands. And that is one of the reasons that you can go out and fight and remove that sovereignty so that you can spread the message. Can we look at that situation that because there is impediments and the restrictions are there, not allowing you to spread the message? That may be working the other way around in the sense that they may be spreading the propaganda or whatever against the Muslim faith or distorting the message of Islam. And this could be taken as a defensive measure to attack the Kufar left. Can we look at it in that way, or it would be a purely offensive and say, look,
if they are spreading the message against Islam in a way that there would be a probability of people taking arms and attacking Muslim land because of that negative propaganda, then of course you can have preemptive measures. And this would be regarded as a defense rather than as an offense. And preemptive measures are always taken by societies who are powerful, and they can stop something, some conspiracy taking place against them. However, this is again, as I said, is a measure of defense, not an offensive type of measure. So offensive measure is usually to spread the message of it.
Okay, I think that's the idea of Muhammad Ali.